Okay, I think my talk dovetails quite nicely with Chris because I'm also going to emphasize the political economy aspects. For me, it really feels like a big honor to be here today as somebody who was born and raised in Germany but who moved to England 15 years ago. I really welcome the opportunity to be able to talk to you about my research. Now, I want to start my presentation by coming back to a question that Felix raised in his introductory remarks. He said, and I quote or paraphrase him here, he said, as anthropologists, we put much trust in the common sense of the common people. And yet, what do we do when this proves indigestible? He said, when the people we usually center in our analyses and in our political positioning are amongst the first to reject our expertise. Now, to me, this question, valid as it is also puzzling in other ways. And this is because I think as anthropologists, we've always worked with people whose views have tended to be very different from those commonly endorsed by Western liberal audiences. I think what makes the current situation different, at least it seems to me, is that the people in question are no longer situated in faraway places, at least not exclusively so. I mean, Mario is going to give a comparative analysis, but rather they tend to be located much closer to home, whatever that means. They typically originate from the same societies in which we as anthropologists work and live. And so we can't avoid but feel implicated by people's positions and viewpoints. And yet, what I want to suggest today is that as a discipline, I think we ought to make sense of the current so-called populist conjuncture in much the same way that anthropologists have made sense of people's positions, viewpoints, and experiences elsewhere, namely through historically embedded and ethnographically informed analysis that links people's everyday narratives, experiences, and processes of livelihood making to the broader political, economic, and historical context in which these are embedded and through which these are produced. And what I want to suggest is adopting such an approach, well established as it is in anthropology, can nonetheless generate some novel insights into current debates. Insights that not only help us, I think, to ultimately humanize, if we want to use that word, the political choices of people who've often been berated as populist, but I think also in this process come to reveal our own conceptual shortcomings or get us thinking a bit more critically about the conceptual repertoire that we use. Okay, all of this sounds really abstract, so I'm first gonna start off by situating the debate on populism in the British context, which is my field site. Then I'm gonna move on to present some key ethnographic inquiries that I've been pursuing in my own research, which taken together, I think, can generate a analytical perspective on the so-called populist moment. And then third, I want to conclude by asking what the broader points are that emerge for a public-facing anthropology. And I'm asking that last point because I was told that this is a public panel, so I was thinking about linking it back to the contributions we can make to public debates. So let me start then by situating the debate on populism in the British context. Now, in Britain, debates around populism really became prominent in the aftermath of the referendum on leaving the EU, which took place on the 23rd of June 2016, when a majority of nearly 52%, so a small majority, of the British population voted in favour of leave. On the right-hand side, you can see a picture of how people voted. Blue is Remain and red is Leave. And what you can see is, broadly speaking, Scotland and Ireland excluded. I won't comment on that. The largest Remain, pro-Remain area really is around the sort of cosmopolitan areas of the southeast in London, whereas the more rural areas and smaller towns predominantly fall within the pro-Leave position. Now, what happened in Britain, and this mirrors much of what Chris said in the Hungarian context, is that very quickly after the referendum, Leave voters found themselves stigmatized by the liberal press and liberal commentary as populist, as racist, and as ignorant. And much of this criticism was directed towards the people living in some of the most impoverished, so-called left-behind communities in Britain, the sort of post-industrial working classes, even though it should be said they were only one of many support groups for the Leave position. Now, I think when sort of talking about the Brexit crisis, it's helpful to remind ourselves that this talk of populism is not actually new in the British context. So Stuart Hall and his colleagues in the late 1970s and 1980s spoke of the rise of popular authoritarianism amongst the working classes, who Stuart Hall saw as turning their back on the post-war social democratic state. Then from the 1990s and 2000s onwards, the sort of debate on populism in Britain moved more into the legal sphere, when social theorists, criminologists, and also legal anthropologists coined terms like populist punitivism or penal populism to essentially describe the process whereby allegedly the common people were turning towards pro-law and order and anti-human rights policies. And then finally, we've seen a return of this debate around populism back into the political sphere, as I've already said, where, for example, the Brexit vote, but also Trump supporters in the US, AfD supporters in Germany, and many movements elsewhere are seen as indicative in the British press as in terms of a rise of popular authoritarianism or authoritarian populism. I think there are important differences across these debates, and my intention is not to collapse them into one. But I do think, at least in the more recent commentary on populism, certain common narratives prevail. In general, I think more recent commentators have seen populist desires as a threat to the liberal constitutional orders and values that we allegedly hold dear in liberal democracy. A dichotomy, in other words, is invoked between the people and the state, one which sees the people, the former, as a threat to the latter, the state. And yet, I think across much of this commentary, knowledge of who the people are has tended to remain very thin. And of course, we now come to a question that is very typical to anthropology. So who are these people then that stand behind this alleged populist vote? Well, before I introduce some of their views based on my own research, I want to say a few words just to introduce my field site. So here, you can see a painting of a typical council estate. It's a painting by a British-born working-class artist called George Shaw, who essentially paints scenes from the neighborhood in which he grew up. Now, what are council estates? They don't exist in the same way in Germany. I guess the sort of best equivalent translation would be something like soziale Wohnbaugebiete. The reason why council estates are called council estates in Britain is because they were built by councils, local authorities, local government bodies, mostly in the post-war decades as large-scale housing developments called estates, hence the name council estate, mostly for Fordist working class. However, for reasons that I'm going to come back to, over the last 30 years or so, many of them have been turned into some of the country's most economically and politically dispossessed neighborhoods. Now, the council estate where I've done most of my own ethnographic fieldwork is typical of these developments. You can see a couple of pictures on the slide. We're talking here about a neighborhood of roughly 13,000 people, mostly white British working class people, but there's always been a sizable minority of people of African Caribbean descent, and relationships between the two groups run very deep. This council estate is situated on the periphery of an otherwise wealthy town in southern England. Now, the residents who live on this community were once tied to a car factory that's actually German-owned and German-run, so it's similar to what Chris was saying. However, since the late 1970s, production has been gradually declining, unemployment and welfare dependence has been going up, and now, with Brexit also impending, the factory has for the time being closed its production. I've been working on this field site since 2009, when I spent an initial period of nearly 2 years working on and living on the estate, and I've been going back since then as much as I can. And I guess what makes my field site interesting for purposes of today's talk is that these are precisely the kinds of people who've been vilified by the liberal commentary, as a majority of them came to vote in favour of Leave at the EU referendum. And these are people who traditionally have not participated in ordinary formal elections. So this was the first vote that many had made in a number of years. So how do I make sense of it? What's going on? Well, I'm going to turn out to a number of I guess, ethnographic analytical inquiries that I pursue in my recently published book, and which I'm going to break down here in the next few minutes. First, much of what I'm trying to do in my book is to question this narrative of crisis that presents a liberal order that has come under threat by its own authoritarian people. And what I show is that the authoritarianism that is often laid at the feet of people in Britain needs to be supplemented by an authoritarianism or a sort of illiberalism of a very different kind, namely the legacies of state-led and state-sanctioned coercion that have tended to operate in precisely those areas of day-to-day life that the liberal state typically deems to be private and to leave alone, namely the sort of domestic, informal, and social spaces of daily life in working class communities. And I refer to this as a form of everyday authoritarianism because I'm concerned with the sort of everyday forms of state control. Now, what I'm trying to do in my book is to trace this legacy of authoritarianism or illiberalism both historically and ethnographically. What I show is that even in the post-war decades, which are commonly held up to be the sort of golden years of the post-war social democratic state, a highly paternalistic state was in existence that was premised on the model of the white, male, and British Fordist worker, and that operated in extremely racialized, gendered, and particularly also classed ways. And yet, I think it was really only with the turn to neoliberal policies in the 1980s, so with the turn to Thatcher, that the sort of state coercion that was always a central part of liberal state making became more explicit. As anthropologists have repeatedly pointed out, then neoliberalism was not the withdrawal of the state, but rather it marked its uneven and coercive expansion into new domains. And you can see that in Britain, in particular in areas of social security and welfare, for example, where shifts towards more punitive forms of means-tested assistance have exposed people to much more coercive forms of state-citizen interaction. Then from the mid-1990s and 2000s onwards, the shift to law and order under the new Labour government's third wave policies further exposed working class people and their neighbourhoods to heightened policing. And then finally from 2010 onwards, following the global economic crisis, all of these processes have been further exacerbated with the shift to so-called austerity politics and what the government calls welfare reform, which have pushed many of my informants literally beyond the brink. Second, what I show in my book is that it is precisely this sort of legacy of state-led control as it has been addressed against some of its most marginalized people that further reinforces a crisis of social reproduction that is becoming more and more pronounced in these communities. And this is because the liberal state often polices and dispossesses precisely those areas of daily life that have already been rendered vulnerable by decades of economic dispossession, namely the sort of everyday livelihood strategies and homemaking practices that people engage in these communities. And just to illustrate this point, I think the most recent shift to austerity reforms in Britain really provides a case in point. So welfare policies like universal credit, I don't know if you've heard of it, it's the name that the British government has given the new social security system that was introduced 3-4 years ago. What these welfare policies do is that they not only expose both those out of work as well as the working poor to extremely tight welfare controls, but also they sanction, this is the official word that the government uses, individuals for their failure to often live up to very minor bureaucratic rules, like going to an appointment with their job coach advisor at the Job Centre Plus, which administers welfare payments. And what this means is that you get sanctioned by the state for your failure to live up to basic bureaucratic rules, which in turn results in benefits being cut, which in turn triggers rent arrears. This in turn can lead to eviction, to homelessness, and finally the forced removal of your children into social care by social workers. And what my book shows is that these processes of dispossession, essentially, are extremely unevenly distributed, with women in working class communities often carrying the bulk of the responsibility of keeping families and communities going under such pressure. And I talk a lot about the sort of creative ways that women adopt to get around the system, to play the system, to navigate the rules, and also how that yet further exposes them to the risk of being called fraudulent or criminal and thus being further dispossessed by the state. Finally, let me come back to politics. What are the implications of the picture that I've presented here in terms of understanding the current political conjuncture? A third sort of inquiry that I pursue is to look at how the sort of legacies of control that I've just sketched out for you feed into a crisis of political representation and democratic disenchantment in these communities. So most of the people, as I said at the beginning, have withdrawn from voting altogether. And indeed, to engage in politics is considered to be, by many people, an inherently immoral affair. So I can talk about this more if anyone's interested later, but people really try and police what they consider to be the moral boundaries between their daily life and everyday sociality and the world of formal politics that they reject. And what I show in my book is that this sort of mistrust of politics needs to be further situated within a broader context of the decline of a political left in the form of the Labour Party and trade union movements, which has created a political vacuum that has slowly been filled by the language of cultural identity politics and victimhood. Mario is going to say more about that sort of cultural aspect, so I'm going to gloss over it. But that's the sort of language of cultural victimhood that has come to replace the language of redistributive politics in these communities, and which has often become the only route or voice people have in terms of expressing their demands. And so what I ultimately argue in the book is that it was precisely this sort of political void that people confront which made the Brexit vote possible. For many of my informants, Brexit was an opportunity to reject politics as they knew it, to not only choose between competing political evils as you would do in an ordinary election where you merely choose between political parties, but rather to say no to a constitutional system of government that they believe they can't trust. And this is why many people I knew who'd never voted in their lives before came to vote in favour of Leave. Some accepted the sort of racist rhetoric of the far right, others did not. But what they all shared was a sort of acute sense that government as they know it needs to be rejected. I'm going to conclude by just talking very briefly about the kinds of contributions that I think a sort of ethnographic analysis of the type I've presented here can make to current and public debates on the populist crisis. And I just want to conclude with three quick points. I think the kind of ethnography and anthropology making that I've presented here can push us to contribute to public debates by getting us to humanize as opposed to moralize those who are commonly seen as populists. All too often, as I've already said, those who vote differently from us tend to be berated for their choices. And yet, as the case of Brexit, for example, shows, at least from the point of view of my informants, their political decision on that day cannot be understood unless we embed it within a much more fundamental, wide-ranging crisis of representation that has been going on for a very long time in these communities. Now, I want to be clear here, when I talk about humanizing, my position is not to collapse back into a form of cultural relativism, nor is it an attempt to romanticize or talk away racism in working class communities, but rather my plea is I appeal for a sort of more historically embedded critical anthropology that situates voter choices within the broader context that people confront. I think a second contribution that we as anthropologists can make to public debates is to question the liberal backdrop against which much of the current commentary and debate on populism has taken place. As Felix has already pointed out, all too often populism has been framed in terms of dichotomies. Dichotomies that see the people as a threat to the supposedly even-handed workings of the liberal order. And yet, I think in the case of Britain, what we see is that this language also silences the legacies of state-led illiberalism that have been central to the liberal state itself, and that have meant that for many people, the idea of liberal individual freedom has never really been fulfilled. And I've illustrated that in relation to class, but obviously we can make very similar arguments in relation to gender and race, where the histories of British imperialism and empire making have never really been acknowledged. So here I think a second contribution that anthropology can make is to really question the conceptual language that has been dominant in much of the public debate on populism. The third point I just want to make quickly is that I think anthropology can also make a contribution in terms of helping to build an alternative political channel, alternative political discourses that can help us move beyond the current conjunction. In Britain, as I've said, the political mechanisms for expressing redistributive demands have largely and gradually been eroded over the last 30 years or so. And yet, let's not forget, and this comes back to something Chris also mentioned, that across history and across space, particularly in South America, Southern Europe, but we also have Eastern European examples, we've had many examples of where leaders and social movements have mobilized so-called populist demands to fight class-based inequalities and exploitation. So I just want to conclude then by saying that far from actually seeing the rise of the far right as an inevitable outcome of the current political conjuncture, I think we ought to be thinking about what it means to create the conditions for thinking more radically about a radical redistributive politics. So I'm going to stop on that note.